difficult to believe, but we've reached the final session of the day, of the weekend rather. And we always finish up traditionally with the panel discussion. And the panel is made up of different types of investor. So we have a multifamily office, a single family office, and an endowment. And of course, the biggest challenge for an emerging manager when they're starting out is attracting capital and ideally attracting the right capital. So this session is all about your questions. It's an opportunity to ask the people who you'd like to attract what they think about when they're allocating capital, what type of traits they're looking for, and whatever else is on your mind. So starting at the right, we've got James. James is an old hand here. I think it's the second or third time he's done this panel, so he very graciously offered to take all the hard questions. and works with Global Endowment, an endowment based in the US. Then we have Claudine, who works for a single family office based in Bilbao in Spain. And finally, Patrick, based in Hamburg, who works for a multifamily office. So three very different types of investor. And before I pass the microphone off to you guys, maybe I'll ask each of you just to briefly introduce yourselves and whatever you want to say about the organizations you work for. Please, Patrick, you go first.
Okay, thank you for inviting me. It's been a pleasure and it's been a wonderful weekend. So thank you, first of all.
Thank you.
I'm from Hamburg. We run a multifamily office. It's just my partner, Stefan, and myself, and we have 70 employees. And we almost exclusively cater to entrepreneurial families and some single families and some trusts. And the way we do it is it's basically an advisory service. So we do advisory on the strategic asset allocation. We source managers like Rob, but maybe we come to that later because it was very difficult not to source him, but to get in. And then we also do, of course, all the administrative stuff. As of today, it's about 6 billion that we advise on or do the numbers for. It's you can book us for whatever service you want. You don't have to use us as a single family office. So maybe that's
important. Yeah, and I've had the privilege to meet some of your investors, and they're all really successful entrepreneurial families based in Germany, and families who oftentimes are not in the public eye in Germany. And I'd just like to make a shout out for your podcast, unfortunately only in German. Maybe there's plans for an English language version, but where you interview some of these really great family companies in Germany.
Yeah, thank you, Rob. I'm still I've done six or seven now, and I'm still learning a lot. I find it very difficult to do a podcast. What Rob's referring to, yesterday you said you try to avoid talking to intermediaries. And I think when I first reached out to you, you thought I'm some sort of private banking guy. So it was very poor communication on my side. But in the end, it's the families that invest directly with Rob. And it's just my job to, find him, due diligence, and then advise my clients on it. But he wouldn't take any meetings. He didn't want anything of this. So when I was with a client in Zurich, I basically pushed through and said, Rob, we are here and we want to meet now. And that was the moment when he understood that actually the type of clients that we have are exactly the type of investors that Rob likes, I think.
Yeah, I've had some wonderful relationships that have come about through that. So thank you for that. Claudine, tell us a little bit about your background.
Okay. Well, I work for a single family office in Bilbao. The family wealth came from an investment in a company that the father operated and then sold. So the family history was the kind of operating investor entrepreneur, and so there was like no real background of being investors, financial investors. Mm-hmm. So the typical
thing. So the business was sold and all of a sudden there's a problem, so where do we invest the capital?
Yeah. Nice problem to have, but one that you have to the one that you have to solve. So the people that the father left in charge were they use their philosophy. So initially and still much of the assets are invested in real estate and which we run internally. Mm-hmm. So we have a team that invests in property for rental, but also building up and selling. And then there was a 20% more or less, which was investing in a portfolio of blue chips that was run by an outside manager who was not a professional manager in the sense that he was running his own money and he ran this portfolio the way he ran his own family money. So it was like a very common sense portfolio of global blue chips that did a good job. But when Idoya and her sister Ada took over about 6 years ago, they felt, first of all, they wanted to internalize the knowledge, not have it all outside and not know what was happening. And also they felt, generationally, they had the assets to be able to have a much longer term view and therefore take some more risk. So I came in as a kind of like new blood to try and help them in that process of being more ambitious in their investments. And then we were very fortunate a month after I joined, we went to a Value Spain event. Mm-hmm. And there I met someone very nice who's here, Rafa León, who introduced me to Rob and other excellent investors. And that's why we're here. So thanks to Rafa.
Yeah. And you're comparatively new to the capital allocation, but what I appreciate about you is an incredible intellectual curiosity. You often ask some of the best questions I come across.
Well, I mean, I come from the dark side. I've been a broker for 30 years, so you learn all the bad things that you don't want. But, I don't know, the internet's been a great thing. And then learning from some other people, they begin to introduce you to things and you start reading and then you realize that there's another alternative universe. And also even within broking, there's some nice, clever people and some good investors. So you kind of migrate towards those people and those people open windows and that helps one to learn.
Yeah, yep. Charlie Munger always says invert, and so it sounds like that's what you're doing. Yeah. Great. Yeah. James.
Good morning.
What's on?
Yes. I'm James. I co-lead our investment team at Global Endowment. It's our 15th anniversary this year as of this summer, which we're very glad to be here. So we invest, our background is our founder was the CIO at Duke University's Endowment. The original idea was to pool small and mid-sized endowments together and then invest as if it were one endowment. That was the basic idea, and that's essentially what's transpired. So we have about 45 clients today. It's really important that we pull them together at the asset class level in particular, because then as we face the market, so we're out in the world looking for the Robs of the world, we can invest through one single structure. And so it makes it very efficient to do, and it allows us to really focus on the core aspect and the most fun part of our job, which is traveling around the world, at least pre-COVID and hopefully post-COVID as well, seeking these managers, most of whom do not want to be found.
Yeah. What was your background prior to coming to GEM?
Yeah, so I have a long and winding background. I graduated from Duke in 2006. I was an econ major. I worked for one of the largest private real estate developers in the U.S. It was an interesting structure, a very entrepreneurial firm. All of the equity capital was internal, and it was created through basically generating development returns and then rinse and repeat. It was an incredible background as a way to learn about an operating business. I saw the best and the worst commercial real estate market in the U.S. in a six-year period. But I really felt like I was swimming upstream. Notwithstanding that it was a great firm, I found myself reading annual reports. I started going to the Berkshire Hathaway meetings with my dad and realized that I was too young to be moonlighting doing this. And so I jumped and was very fortunate to be connected with GEM back in almost 11 years ago.
Awesome. Awesome. And it's great to have you here. I think you've been almost everyone, right?
It's very good to be here.
Yeah. So, the idea is now that the microphones get passed over to the floor for questions. So I pass them. We're going to keep two up here, so we'll have to share. And I'll take two. It's fine. You can keep that, Claudine. And Ollie and Tommy will pass around and just raise your hand.
Great. Peace.
Test.
Okay. Jonas from Germany again. Thank you all for serving on the board and giving us an opportunity to ask questions. I will ask one a bit more tricky. Why don't you put all your money into indexing, and why do you spend so much time looking for the ROBs of the world?
Who wants to go take a
look? It's a very good question, because in my own reports, I always compare to the index, and the history is that we haven't done as well as the index. But there is a different sense of ownership, I think, when you have an index than when you have either direct investments or via a manager who has a sense of ownership in companies. So as the family had the mantra is we want to be active investors. We want to know what we're doing. We want to know where we're invested, and we want to learn from our investments, both in terms of the companies we're invested in and the way the investors invest. So the index gives you a broad range, and you can, you know, you don't have to work, but you don't learn. So I think that would be my answer to that.
Maybe I add one thing. These entrepreneurs, they don't like to be average. And even though they know that, of course, we try to communicate and tell them that it doesn't make a lot of sense to have a 30 company or 50 company concentrated portfolio, they still sometimes don't feel that they want to have all their equities just in an ETF. So they fundamentally like the idea of being an owner of a company. And that puts them straight onto one captain ships with very concentrated or 5 to 10 company portfolios, because they can understand that it relates to their own entrepreneurial journey, and they can talk to Rob, or they can talk to the investor, and they like that. So it's and of course they like to beat the index. It gives them satisfaction if that's working out. And so I can just say, for our clients, it's often a combination that they do own some ETFs, and then they also give money to some one captain ships.
Okay. No, I didn't have anything. Okay. No, the only thing I would add is I think it's worth just acknowledging that it's a brutally competitive game. And so sitting in our seats, I feel very, very fortunate to meet some of the best and most talented investors in the world. And notwithstanding, you know, someone who set up their firm in a perfect way, especially in the public markets for a long only stock picking shop, the odds are against you. The odds are against us. We certainly do not have a tailwind behind our backs. That notwithstanding, I think there's a small group of investors out there in the world. We've been fortunate to be in that group over time, although it's been, you know, tough lately, where you are capable of beating the market. And so it's not that the pursuit is not worth following, but I think it's worth acknowledging the odds from the outset.
I wasn't planning on commenting, but there was one thought I wanted to put out there, which is, you know, obviously an event like this and the reason you guys have all traveled here is really to talk about investment excellence and to learn how to be a great investor. But it's worth remembering that that's not how the industry as a whole works. If you think of the average private bank or investment bank or a large fund management company, they're not built for investment returns. They're built for raising capital, and the fund manager's incentives are to cover their asses, not to create great performance. And, you know, so all of that is in that sort of average that goes into then the statistic that, you know, on average, the active fund doesn't beat the market. But a lot of the active funds aren't really trying, if we're honest. So I think that's worth bearing in mind as well.
Well, I mean, as other people have said here before, we cannot predict where interest rates will go, and we just don't know. So what we can do is build resilient portfolios. So our risk management very much takes place on the strategic asset allocation. And so you asked about private investments. Most of our families, they are about 60% of their wealth in private investments. So, and when we think about asset allocation, for us, it actually doesn't matter if you're invested in a private equity fund, a direct investment in a company, or a company listed on a stock exchange. You're basically buying the future cash flows. So when it comes to illiquidity, from my perspective, it is a protection for our families not to be too emotional when they invest their money. So I don't know where the markets are going. So I can only tell you, in the 15 years that we've been doing this, we're only twice basically changed fundamental ideas about the strategic asset allocation. And it was one, this is about 8 years ago, we said we're not going to do any bonds anymore. Listed debt is not an interesting risk-reward perspective. And we added venture capital at one point. And that's the only changes we made.
I might comment on the rate side, which I cringe even bringing this up. But one of my favorite things to do, and one of the things we do on the team a lot, not specifically to rates, but just in general, is look at the what do you have to believe question. That's as it relates to a single stock, an industry, a manager's portfolio, and look at what the market is pricing. And so one thing we did at the end of January of this year, when rates was obviously before Ukraine had turned into what it's turned into, was really the key question that was being asked is, what do you have to believe if you look at companies today, many of which are the largest businesses in the world? An interesting thing is many of those companies were not remotely priced for interest rates to be really high, meaning you had a pretty significant margin of safety, even if rates, at least in the U.S., went up to the 10-year, let's say 3%, 4%, 5%. If you looked at the Ford market was not suggesting that you were going to get to that level. But even if you did get to that level, many of those businesses, we talked about Facebook earlier, but if you look at Google as another example, those businesses arguably, just with a basic dividend discount model, should have been trading at 60 times earnings. And instead, they were trading at 25 or 30 or 20, depending on what you're willing to adjust. And so one of the things that we observed that was interesting is that the market, quote unquote, was very concerned about interest rates, but that really didn't seem to translate to the single company level, at least in some of the largest businesses.
In our case, I think the discussion is important because we have a lot of real estate. So, the real estate cycle has been driven significantly by falling interest rates and the search for yield. So, and with COVID, you realize that it's not necessarily a safe indexed asset because the asset supposedly is indexed, but is no longer useful. So the discussion is not just on the impact that rising rates will have on yields, but also on the utility and the usefulness of the asset and whether it actually does have pricing power, even if the contract has the indexing within it. And then as we have a relatively low proportion of equity, for us this is an opportunity to actually increase our equity weighting where we think that there's more capacity to hedge against inflation and create value through actual growth in earnings.
Hi, this is Moritz from Germany. I had an interesting conversation with an attendee here earlier, and we were both wondering why nobody brought this topic up so far. It's about crypto, and my best guess was because our biggest role models, Charlie and Warren, consider it red poison. I believe Charlie even said it's, or Warren said it's red poison squared. But I will just give it a shot then. So do you have any opinion on the space? Are you looking at it? Do you maybe have exposure to it? Or what's your view on the matter?
I can do that. We have no exposure to it, but our colleague who's building up the private equity side, in fact, I didn't answer that bit of your question, which I'll come back to. On a PA basis, he's super interested. So he has a group of friends, weird friends or whatever it is, and very interested. So in fact, even next week, we're going to have a meeting with our bank where we're going to see their expert. And well, we think we have to know what the blockchain is, what it means. I mean, even in real estate, how contracts will be signed, you know, just building up knowledge rather than feeling that we have to be in the asset because the asset's going up or whatever it is. So it's we are beginning to do our homework to just understand what use that will be long term.
Yes. Sure. Yeah. No problem. I mean, the only thing maybe worth mentioning is we cover all public and private asset classes around the world. I gravitate towards public, and that's just the area that I prefer and is my home base. I think through the public lens, it's hard to argue that there's really a competitive advantage for a fundamental stock picker in that area. Where we've seen more of it is on the private side. We do have a few investments there, primarily with blue chip firms. Partially, it's a way to learn and to really push ourselves. I think there's no question that the technology and what it's potentially capable of is incredibly impressive. And I think a lot of the question is really, how do you monetize that and what does it look like over time? We had a good discussion in the gondola yesterday of, would you have invested in Amazon in 1999 from an expected value standpoint? Would that have been the better bet? Or someone else that we were with said, or would it have been better to invest in 2008? And I think that analogy is interesting as it relates to crypto.
I think most people in this room, not all, struggle with crypto and somehow get their heads around the blockchain. Same for us. So what we don't do generally is investing just in currencies, for example. I mean, there's no opinion where the dollar is going, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't have an opinion on where the Bitcoin is going. But what we did and what we still do is we try to understand the blockchain, and we have given a manager money that is basically investing in companies that invest in the blockchain or in business models on the blockchain. So that's what we've done. Don't have enough knowledge to really understand this in a way asset class. But one thing I'm pretty sure, it's not going away, and we do need to build up the knowledge to invest in that space.
Yeah, it really reminds me of investing in telecoms and the internet in the 1990s. There was this really strong sense in the 90s that the internet was a thing, this idea of connecting people together through a data network. It was absolutely clear that was going to be something big that changes the world, but it wasn't clear which companies or which business models were going to work. Businesses were based off of eyeballs, and almost, I think eBay was the only company that managed to monetize in those early stages. So it was clear it was going to be something, but it wasn't clear what the winners were going to be. And in actual fact, of all the companies that started in the 90s, none of them really turned out to be the really successful ones, apart from Amazon and to a lesser extent, eBay. All the other sort of great internet companies sort of came in the second and third waves. So it reminds me a lot of that. And although I'm sure, crypto will be a really big thing and change the world in the years to come, I doubt that the most successful companies have even been started yet.
Sorry, I didn't answer the question on the private side. It is a strategic aim of the family to build up, but we have a couple of investments in funds in growth private equity. So they're financing companies to grow rather than buyout strategy. But the family's aim is to try and build direct investments in a few companies where we can be minority investors. And again, going back to this idea of trying to be active, real owners of companies and not just, a fund that compounds or whatever it is. So the idea of being close to the underlying investment. So that's a really slow process. We recognize that's really difficult to do, and so we're just going to be, we're learning a lot, in fact, from some of the conversations here about being patient about that objective, but it is an aim to be in privately private assets. And again, one of my mantras, should we say, is what you just said, is that it's business. So how do you own businesses? Do you own them directly, or do you own them via owning stocks, or do you own them via managers that buy the company? So like it's seamless, really.
Hi, I'm Arnaldo from Italy. I know it's not the primary concern for a fundamental investor, but I'd like to know how the ESG trend that is emerging is affecting you, if it is affecting you in some way in terms of allocation, decisions, and so on. Thank you.
Which trend?
I didn't catch it. The
ESG. ESG, okay.
I think this is something that is a lot of concern to families. You want to feel that your investments are worthy. And when I joined the family, I was like quite anti-ESG because I thought any good investment does that process of you know, what is good governance. I mean, I thought it was like obvious, like the G is super important. You know, that your companies are not going to do things that are going to produce environmental problems and that they look after their employees and they create jobs. And so I was anti the whole, you know, thing that you have to have this cookie cutter issue. But it's become a thing. I mean, a lot of the funds that we see, suddenly they're super ESG concerned, and they all show how their process gives you the ESG and gets the points. And so, you know, it also produces a bit of anti-reaction because of how much of marketing is involved in the ESG process. But I think, you know, any good company has those concerns. It's a question of whether you're ticking the boxes and using the prints that people want to, that you have the right points, or whether it's the actual investment process that takes you towards those outcomes. But it is a concern, yeah. And particularly on the private side, where we're going to decide which companies we buy, there we have more control over, you know, how they're managed and what their objectives are.
Maybe I add one thing. What we see is many families, when they get the next gen getting involved in investing the money, this ESG theme is everywhere. So, and there are huge conflicts in these families. So we have situations where maybe the daughter is now 24 and she looks at the portfolio that her dad has built and she says, we have to sell it all. This has all to go. And I mean, these are, from my perspective, I'm very much in your camp here, very actually ESG conscious portfolios. And you know, I mean, there's housing involved and all sorts of things that you can say this makes the world a better place. What we are struggling with is this trend of greenwashing, actually. Because suddenly this girl is fine when you have a stamp, and you know that doesn't really make sense. And you know, we try to look for all these investments and then present them to our clients. And then what we don't want to do is, you know, we have three funds investing in weapons and porn, and now we have the ESG bucket, and the girl will do that one, and the rest of the year her dad will do the other three. You know, that doesn't make sense at all. So that's, but it's a huge thing in our firm. We have to get a framework we can really work with, and there's no black and white. And sometimes, especially the next gen, they would like to have it black and white, and that's difficult.
Yeah, James is looking at me as something we've discussed quite a lot. And, you know, I think it's a positive thing. What I increasingly hear is people are approaching companies and asking them about their ESG policies and, you know, what they're doing for various causes that they care about. And on balance, I think that's a good thing. But there's a lot of muddied thinking about it as well. You know, one of the things that drives me crazy is sort of this idea that oil companies are not ESG. And I mean, you know, our society runs on oil. I mean, it's not just for running the tractors that produce the food; it's for producing the plastics. We wouldn't be sitting here today if there weren't people who went out there to sort of drill oil and you know, at risk to their own lives, by the way, and so that we can use it. So when I hear sort of people sort of moralizing about how unethical an oil producing company is, I get quite upset.
Hi everyone. Mikolai here from Zurich. So first of all, thank you, Rob, for organizing this. I've been reading your letters and some of the early ones about how you started out. Found particularly personally, because I'm also here in Switzerland, I found the early letters very appealing, relatable, and were definitely like an inspiration to kind of take the jump and become an independent manager quite recently. So thank you, and thank you for organizing this. So I have a question kind of around structuring, and I think in the earlier discussion with Joel, you kind of mentioned the kind of chicken and egg problem that a lot of emerging managers have. And, you know, I kind of semi got around solving it through the kind of family and friends type of route of raising initial capital, which in my current structure kind of keeps me afloat and does, you know, lets me sleep at night, not worrying about the costs. But it is a separately managed account structure, and it's perhaps not something that's scalable to the types of institutions like the ones that the panelists here represent. And my question would be kind of around this structuring issue. To what extent would you kind of expect an emerging manager to come to you and kind of have a ready structure for you that you can invest in, perhaps as a fund structure, because that's kind of something I'm considering. But then if I take the wrong approach and perhaps doesn't suit the institution accordingly, and to what extent would you kind of be open to kind of also helping the manager with that particular aspect of it? And yeah, how do you think about that, particularly for managers like really in the early stages of starting out? Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for the question. I think it's a really hard one. If our assumption is always that the hardest part from our standpoint is to find the investor that we want to partner with, I would echo a lot of the sentiments earlier that this is very much a qualitative endeavor. Ultimately, it's essentially a game of trust. And so you're trying to find people that during those very dark moments or during the inevitable periods of underperformance, you have confidence in their ultimate judgment. To me, that's a much more difficult thing to figure out. If and when we figure that out, we always assume that we can solve for structure. And so we've been very involved in a number of different structures in the past and have worked very closely with the managers, whether it's on day one or opening a separate account, setting up a separate account at a new custodian. The one thing maybe of caution is it's easy on the chicken and the egg front, I think, to set up a structure in anticipation of having, quote unquote, the big institution come in. And the trick is that can become quite unwieldy. And so it's a little bit of, if you build it, will they come? I on a personal level, generally prefer to or would suggest that managers avoid that, because I think it can just put them in a very difficult position where you can end up easily with a subscale overall structure. So let's say you set up a master feeder and you have an onshore fund, an offshore fund, and a separate account, all of which end up being subscale. The cost to the small business of the firm at the time can be quite overwhelming.
In our case, it's the first part of what you said is true. The most important thing is the manager and what job they will do for us in terms of the investment return. But it's true that there's an economy of scale. We have 13 people in our family office, and I was very fortunate in when we wanted to invest with Rob that we had the people who could come up with all the paperwork on the beneficial owners and the ultimate owners and whatever it is. It was if I'd been in a smaller office without those people, I think it would have been difficult. So it depends, who you're trying to attract and whether they have the capacity to deal with a difficult structure.
In the context of a multifamily office, you have another layer that is a bit problematic, and that is that we as a firm have to be regulated to advise our clients on people like Rob. So we have to look into this from two perspectives. On the one hand, there has to be a solution for the asset manager. It has to be as easy and smooth as possible for the asset manager. On the other hand, it has to be smooth for our clients. So we are thinking, we actually solved some of these problems in a way that we could also even offer asset managers that we like a structure they could use. So, but for example, for liquid investments, this is not working right now, but we're trying to find a solution, because thinking about our own business as building a moat, that is a huge moat. If we could get there, that we are the one-stop shop for an asset manager, that where we basically provide, we take away the problems that some of you guys are thinking about, that would actually be a nice thing to do. And we are not the asset manager in any case, but we would be the, well, provider of the solution to get it done. But we're there in some cases. Especially the illiquid stuff is we take care of now. But on the illiquid side, we don't have all the regulation right now.
I'll just add one more point. I've had this discussion a lot with Rafa on it kind of self-selects. People that set up a UCITS fund want to be able to grow more easily. People who have a more difficult structure mean that they want investors that are willing to live with a more difficult structure. So you, again, it depends on what your objectives are.
Any other questions? If not, maybe I'll ask one. What I'm curious about is maybe some of the pitfalls you've come across, kind of managers that looked like they were on a good track, or maybe even were on a good track, but kind of messed up. What are the kind of, what are the big mistakes to avoid?
Thanks for that one, Rob. Well, actually, one problem that we figured out was when you get to very specialized, niche strategies, we often like them a lot, and it's never a problem if it's just, say, three or four of our clients investing, and then the asset manager is putting his money in, and basically, when you run into trouble, you just sit around a table and find a solution that is a good solution long-term. So that's easy. So, of course, there are problems with some investments, and then you can just figure them out. But what a mistake we made in the past is when you get into some structures where you have some outside investors, say you have a fund with 30 million euro, for example, and maybe 10, 15 million would be from our clients, and then you have some other outside clients that you don't even know, and you have these semi-liquid structures. That is highly problematic in the moment when some event happens, and some of these other investors just run to the door. And then suddenly you're not in control of the situation, and everybody might lose money. So we try to avoid the situations now. But that was a learning. We had actually two investments where this happened, and I didn't see it coming. And it was really a shame, because you could have figured these things out, but with some people panicking, you cannot control it.
Well, we had a very, for me, distressing experience this year of, I told Rob about it, a fund management company that attracted a very experienced emerging market investor and set up a fund. And so they were offering a very attractive seed investment asset class. Share class, and the whole thing was very compelling. The managers were extremely experienced. They were very long term. I did the whole due diligence process, other people checking them out, and we was with the managers several times, and so it was great. Became seed investors. 7 months later, I get a notification, shareholder change, that the manager is leaving. And I, how could this happen? And to be honest, I don't know what questions I could have asked to have figured out that could have happened. So I guess these things happen. But now I think I will be far more focused on people that aren't in an institution, professional, where you think that, this is my opportunity to make a lot of money, and much more in someone much smaller without all this institutional backing that gives you a sense of security. Well, it doesn't. It doesn't give you that security. So that's my real painful learning experiences here.
We have a long list of learnings, both ones that we've observed and mistakes that we've made. Maybe I'll speak to two, though. Concentration at the portfolio level and then teams, so I'll split them into two. I think concentration is an especially interesting topic. Obviously, many of us have read all the Berkshire letters and have a lot of respect for the approach with which Buffett and many of those types of partnerships generated the returns. But I think, you know, speaking from the standpoint of an LP, it's an interesting idea because it's really an outcome. So in the perfect world, if you could find a collection of, let's say, 100 or 1,000 mispriced securities, all of which had similar expected values, it'd be great to have the benefit of diversification. But arguably, the reason that you end up with a concentrated portfolio is markets are mostly efficient. And so it's very hard to find that small collection of securities that are mispriced. But I think that nuance is actually quite important. And so we've seen managers who've ended up with a position that's really oversized and doesn't match the conviction that they have. They don't even necessarily realize it at the time, but then end up in a position where they're almost cornered, not specifically from a flow standpoint, but just mentally where they've built this position. And you have, when you have a big position that's going down, it's easy to really end up feeling like you're cornered and become quite stubborn. And so that's an area where a lot of the great returns have been generated that way, many of which shown up in books like The Outsiders or companies that were written about in The Outsiders. But there's a lot of other situations that have not been written about. And so very much embrace concentration and appreciate it. It's been a key driver behind our returns. But I think the why is extremely important there. And then the second one is really just on team. There's no more difficult situation than when a team is really learning who they are, what they're made of, when the market is basically screaming at you, the team, that you have no idea what you're doing. All investors go through that. We've seen a couple situations, one in particular I will speak to, where we had an investment with the manager. They were effectively 50-50 partners, which is dramatically different than 50 plus one versus 50 minus one. And so this was a position, you know, I think if you even look at Munger and Buffett, they're talked about as partners and they are very much partners, but it's clearly been Buffett driving those returns over time from a decision-making standpoint. So this particular situation, the managers, they didn't explicitly have two portfolios, but they effectively were operating that way. And so one of these managers, the securities that he was buying, he continued to really struggle, ended up in, with a number of companies that didn't work out. And it created a lot of tension amongst those two managers. They basically split without telling us or themselves. They moved to different cities, effectively had a falling out. And you know, if you think about the economics behind a lot of these businesses, you're heavily incentivized potentially to do that in that particular situation. And so to the extent that you do have a team or are thinking about working with the team, I think it's worth just being very clear at the beginning of what the objectives are of everyone in the room, how the decision-making works, what's the overall growth plan, what everyone's signing up for, just so you have a better shot of enduring those difficult periods. Any other questions? If not, I'll ask another one.
So maybe a question people are a little bit shy to ask, but I'll ask it is, what is the best way to approach you guys? Patrick, you want to go first? Or let me just, I'll give you 20 more seconds to think and just maybe add a point. Maybe it's best not to approach you. Maybe you prefer to find things yourself. So maybe that's an answer, but I'll give you an extra 20 seconds. And now here's the microphone.
Well, you always say you don't do marketing. And in a way, the way you worked me was fantastic marketing from my point of view. You really wanted me to get in and you rejected me twice. And that kind of was a sell signal for me, a buy signal for me, sorry. I think, I mean, probably, I don't know, it's probably the same for you. It's often good if you get it through a recommendation. Because at least the guy approaching you has gone through the process of thinking, okay, how can I approach this guy? And then has put some work into, I don't know, what's his, what people does this guy know? And do I know anybody that he knows? And I can ask him if he can do the intro. That is something maybe, the intro isn't that important, but at least you get the first data point is that they have put enough effort into this whole thing. What I find sometimes strange is just getting a cold mail in LinkedIn. So, I mean, it's simply impossible to answer all these mails. So, so that would be my, I mean, if the question goes in, okay, how do you approach? I would always say at least put enough effort into trying to get it through a recommendation. Then, because I mean, just to give you an idea, we we look at about 300 investment ideas over all asset classes in a year, and we invest about 20 of them. So that's about our ratio. And so it's sometimes it's just the noise we have to get through, and that's sometimes not easy. I don't want, you know, it's my problem, it's not your problem, but you would help me with that approach.
Yeah, let's make it. I think that's such a great idea. And it brings home to me just how important it is to have a wide network so that you know people who are able to make that introduction. And it also makes me realize we had the comment or the question earlier from you, Claudine, about lack of female representation, for example, how important it is for people like me to make sure underrepresented groups are present at places like this, because that's where networks happen, which lead to introduction, which lead to funds. Yeah.
Well, this is one of the interesting things of when I started this job. I've been a broker. No one wants to speak to you, you know, so you're calling and no one wants to speak to you. And we always just say, can you at least get a, like, no thank you? And that no thank you was already a win, you know, that someone actually answered your email or your Bloomberg message or whatever. When I changed to this side, suddenly everyone wanted to speak to me. It was like everyone was so nice and so I you know... So I thought, oh, and you're, that's such a brilliant question, and you're so smart. And so I had to learn that was not real.
Intellectual transfer.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, since then, what I have had to do is select things that I don't want to see. You know, so things that we're not going to do, then there's no point. Initially, I wanted to learn about everything, so I should see everyone. But then you have to decide what kind of things you're looking for. So, you know, basically we want to invest in businesses. So what really helps is, you know, people that show their thinking. So your letters were obviously super useful. But there needs to be some way that you learn that you're interested in the way that person thinks. And so I think some way to show your thinking, which is either your portfolio and being able to explain why it's like that, or, you know, letters or something that helps. And that for me is a really good introduction, because otherwise it's, you know, you have nothing to go on. So we do try and see as many people as we can, but in the end you have to select for the kind of thing that you're looking for.
Yeah, I love both of those. Patrick stole my thunder. I think that's the favorite way. I mean, like many aspects of life, Rob, you've talked about often when you get warm introductions to companies through peer fund managers, you've got a higher chance that it's a fit for you. And I would very much echo and share that sentiment as it relates to managers. I think one of the hardest things is thinking about when you do approach initially sort of what the objective is. And so whether it's, you know, someone trying to raise money immediately, is it a longer game, both of which are fine. But just being clear about that up front, certainly, and I think we can certainly do a better job of that, of not just explaining our process, but also setting expectations for, is this something that is going to be an open and close where there's an initial shot and that's it? I personally struggle with those types of launches, because it's very difficult to get to know someone in that environment where you're under the gun. We see this all the time on the private side, with no disrespect intentionally, but that's just the nature of how that particular type of fundraising works. The ideal way that we've gotten to know many of our managers is really over time. And I know that's easy to say sitting in the chair that we sit in. It sounds very non-commercial when someone's trying to build their business and really needs that initial dollar so that they can fund some of those operating expenses. But we've had some of our best relationships really come out of that. I think about a couple investments we made in 2 years ago that both of those managers we initially met in 14, 15. Obviously, all of our manager relationships don't take that long. We're happy to make investments quicker than that. But I think from both sides, the longer that you have to get to know someone and the more environments in which you can see them on both sides of the table, the better chance of success once you ultimately do invest.
There's a question at the back there. I think looking at the time, we make this the last one.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm Peter Villa from Cape Town, South Africa. We run a fund domiciled in South Africa. My question is on fund jurisdictions. Do you have a list of jurisdictions that you prefer, that you don't like, that you totally ignore because of the tax or whatever rules applicable to those jurisdictions? I was just interested to hear your thoughts on just jurisdiction of funds, especially given our background and being based in South Africa. The fund does invest globally, but it's regulated and domiciled in South Africa.
You're called Global Endowment. So thanks. Part of the reason I'm pausing is I don't have a specific view on the South African regulation. I mean, we've invested with funds throughout the world, both onshore and offshore. Many of the endowments prefer offshore funds. We've actually found that onshore typically works just fine if you look at the cost of going through UBTI. But we do have funds investments in the fund structure that are both onshore and offshore. I think the one jurisdiction we've struggled a lot with, and I think many people have, is domestic India. So there's a number of great managers that we've met that are set up in India. Arguably the best ones are either not based there or invest through Mauritius or other places. And so that's the only specific area that we've had a pretty tough time sort of cracking the nut of how to get through that regulatory burden.
I just go back to my economies of scale problem. You know, when you're small, it's very different, a family office to an institution. The resources you have for doing difficult things are limited. So simplicity, you do have to build simplicity into the how you manage the assets. So, you know, we tend to look for something that is easier to invest in rather than something that's complicated. We're on a process, though. You know, if eventually we found something that was complicated, maybe we'd try. But simplicity is still, we need to focus on that.
From my side, I can relate to what I said before. We figured out a way to basically invest on a global scale in closed-end funds. That's actually possible, no matter from where. But we still haven't figured out how to do it with liquid portfolios and open funds, but that's our regulation. We're trying to work on that, and then I'd love to have a look at a South African portfolio.
Great. Well, thank you so much, everybody, for coming. We made it. It's possible you can have a big group event again.